This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, August 6, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. President Bush and Afghan President Hamid Karzai meet in Camp David to discuss that country's future. Human rights activists in the Philippines say that a new charter may not go far enough in dealing with the region's problems. And hundreds of day laborers and their allies converge in Washington, D.C. to add their voices to the immigration debate. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. A new report says over 30% of U.S. weapons provided to Iraqi security forces have been lost. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, D.C.
30% means around 190,000 lost arms. U.S. officials have repeatedly accused Iran and Syria of funding insurgent efforts in Iraq. Now it seems the Pentagon itself may be inadvertently helping insurgents fight U.S. troops. Rachel Stoll is the senior analyst for the Center for Defense Information.
Well, according to sources I've talked to at the Defense Department, unfortunately, at least some of the weapons they know are ending up in the hands of criminals and insurgents, and they know this because they've been discovered in raids or in cars of people stopped at checkpoints.
The Pentagon has put weapons into the hands of Sunni insurgents under the pretext of recruiting those insurgents to fight the influence of Al-Qaeda. The U.S. has also armed Iraqi security forces, ostensibly so that Iraqis can take over internal policing duties. But Stoll says the Pentagon needs to immediately set up an administrative process to track U.S. weapons, which she says they have failed to do. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A military court has sentenced a U.S. soldier to 110 years in prison after finding him guilty of the rape and murder of 14-year-old Iraqi girl Abir Qasem Hamza and the murder of her parents and 6-year-old sister. Private Jesse Spielman was also convicted of conspiracy charges and of breaking and entering. He is the fourth soldier sentenced in the case. A fifth man, former Army Private Stephen Green, will face a civilian trial later this year. Green had been discharged from the Army due to psychological problems before details of the crime emerged. The prosecution has indicated that they will seek the death penalty for Green. 21 South Koreans continue to be held hostage by the Taliban in Afghanistan, threatened with death unless the kidnappers' demands are met. South Korea's attempts to persuade Kabul to arrange a prisoner exchange have failed. Now many Koreans want the U.S. to play a greater role in freeing the hostages. FSRN's Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
A Taliban spokesperson said today that the fate of the remaining hostages lies in the hands of President Bush and Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Many South Koreans also believe that Washington holds the key to gaining the hostages' release. There have been daily demonstrations outside the American embassy in Seoul demanding that the U.S. directly negotiate with the kidnappers. One woman attending a candlelight vigil for the hostages says that Washington needs to act quickly.
I think America has some power of responsibility for this hostage accident, and they haven't done anything yet, so that makes us angry.
Several news outlets report they have received calls from some of the hostages. Two of the victims are said to be seriously ill and have been denied medical treatment. Korean officials in Afghanistan have been attempting to arrange face-to-face talks with the kidnappers, but the two sides have yet to agree on a location. For Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
Waters from the floods that have devastated entire swaths of South Asia have begun to recede in India and Nepal. Hardest hit is the Indian state of Bihar, where an estimated 11 million people have been affected. Most of Bangladesh remains underwater. The lack of basic necessities among the millions of displaced persons has sparked fights over food aid and clean drinking water. For many parts of South Asia, it is the worst flooding in living memory. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met today in the West Bank city of Jericho in preparation for an international Mideast conference slated for November. It was the first time in 7 years that an Israeli leader has held talks in the West Bank. Lebanon held important elections over the weekend to replace two cabinet members assassinated in the last 8 months. in an election district north of Beirut, two Christian factions representing pro- and anti-government forces have been wrestling over control of Lebanon's Christian leadership. Jackson Ellers reports from Beirut.
Former Lebanese President Amin Gemayel has apparently lost the most hotly contested of two election campaigns to Kamil Khoury, his Christian opponent aligned with the anti-government opposition party Hezbollah. Amin Gemayel was attempting to replace his son, Pierre Gemayel, who was assassinated last November. Analysts say that by beating former President Gemayel with a lesser-known candidate, the opposition is in a better position to win the September presidential elections. This favors their attempts to reform the government. The current president, Amir Lahoud, must step down by November 23rd. Lahoud is aligned with the opposition, and the pro-Western government has accused him of being a Syrian collaborator. Syria effectively ruled over the Lebanese political scene for 29 years, until they were forced out by a UN Security Council resolution following the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in 2005. Government supporters implicate Syria in Hariri's death and the assassination of the two ministers, Pierre Gemayel and anti-Syrian MP Walid Aido, this June. In another election in Beirut, pro-government candidate Mohamed Amini Tani easily won a Sunni seat in parliament to replace the slain Aido. Meanwhile, former President Amin Gemayel has alleged fraud and is calling for a recount. Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
President Bush signed into law over the weekend a program that would greatly expand the government's surveillance powers, and it shifts the oversight of the program from the judiciary to the executive branch. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Less than 24 hours after it passed Congress, President Bush signed the surveillance program into law. It allows the National Security Agency to wiretap phone lines, emails, and other communications, as long as one end of the line is believed to be overseas.
So if one person is outside the United States, definitely, and one person is inside the United States, they can gather, they can acquire and analyze and listen to that call or read that email. If that person abroad is a United States citizen, they can still gather and listen to that conversation without a warrant.
Lisa Graves is the deputy director of the Center for National Security Studies. She says the government is also allowed to sit on the wire. The wiretapping doesn't have to stop, even if the communication is deemed irrelevant when it becomes clear a suspected terrorist is not on the line.
This law will unleash the United States government to conduct warrantless surveillance on millions, literally millions of Americans in this country.
The bill also removes foreign intelligence surveillance courts, the court system in charge with oversight, from having any significant role. The oversight is transferred to the Director of National Intelligence, Mike McConnell, and to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Even though Congress has deemed Gonzalez untrustworthy, Congress gave him the authority to oversee and approve the surveillance program. Tim Lynch is the director of the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice.
Well, it does represent a power shift from the judiciary into the executive branch.
In 2006, the administration came under intense scrutiny for possible violations of the 1978 law called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They sidestepped the FISA courts. Because of congressional and public pressure, the president was forced last year to bring the program back into the court system. Caroline Fredrickson is Washington director of the American Civil Liberties Union. She says Congress just legalized the president's program that they were so upset with.
Congress not only legalized the president's warrantless spying program, but it actually made it so that the president no longer has to even show that there's any connection to a terrorist.
President Bush fully implemented a public relations campaign last week based on urgency, citing an increased terrorist threat, he said. He pinned the consequences, a possible terrorist attack, on the Democrats if they failed to provide the president with greater ability to wiretap. So over the weekend, trying to finish up a series of bills before members headed home for a month, Democrats conceded to administration pressure. They quickly passed the administration's surveillance program to avoid looking weak on terrorism. In a written statement, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, member of the Intelligence Committee, wrote that Director of National Intelligence Mike McConnell convinced her that the U.S. was vulnerable. She supported it. Again, Tim Lynch with Cato.
these legislators are willing to vote for almost anything because they are so fearful of the political consequences of voting against something that is called an anti-terrorism measure.
The law will sunset in 6 months. Congress says they will look for better surveillance options for the next time. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
President Bush hosted Afghan President Hamid Karzai at Camp David. They concluded a 2-day working meeting today in which they explored options to improve security and reduce poppy production. At a joint news conference concluding their visit, the two allies provided cordial praise of each other's efforts in stabilizing the country and barely spoke about the burgeoning violence there and the reemergence of the Taliban.
There's still a fight going on, but I'm proud to report to the American people that the Afghan Army is in the fight. The government's in the fight, and the Army's in the fight.
President Karzai was quick to reassure President Bush of his commitment.
As we have gone a long way, progress has been made. We still continue to fight terrorism. Our enemy is still there, defeated, but still hiding in the mountains. And our duty is to complete the job, to get them out of their hideouts in the mountains, and to bring justice to the people of Afghanistan, to the people of America, and to the people around the world who are threatened by these terrorists.
In an interview on CNN yesterday, President Karzai said the security situation in Afghanistan has gotten worse in the past 2 years. Karzai and Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf will meet in Afghanistan on Thursday to talk about Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations is creating a charter that would eventually enable the formation of a regional human rights body. The move has raised expectations that the 40-year-old group is finally taking steps to become more active in dealing with problems in the region. But as FSRN's Gurley Linnau reports from Manila, civil society groups are concerned that rules proposed for the 10-member organization have been watered down.
The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, has often been criticized for failing to take greater action in improving the abysmal human rights records of its 10 member countries. But in recently concluded meetings in Manila, ASEAN foreign ministers agreed that it was time for the regional bloc to confront the issues of human rights, democracy, and good governance in a proposed charter for the 40-year-old group. The ministers have agreed to form a regional human rights body, but have yet to reach consensus on its scope of work, when it would be created, and who would be its members. Despite the difficult task ahead, ministers believe it was the right first step. Philippine Foreign Secretary Alberto Romulo says the inclusion of the human rights provision in the charter would help boost ASEAN's credibility.
We will show the world that ASEAN has the cohesion, the foresight, and the drive to chart its own destiny. A people-centered ASEAN is the keystone of our vision.
The decision to include the creation of a human rights body in the ASEAN Charter came after days of difficult discussions among diplomats. Myanmar and newer members Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam reportedly opposed the creation of the Human Rights Commission amid apprehension that the issue could be used as a political instrument. Malaysian Foreign Minister Syed Hamid Albar says the ministers move step by step towards the opinion that the ASEAN must show its critics that the group cares for human rights and democracy.
At the end of the day, we must be seen not to be allergic or not supportive of human rights. If for any reason the human rights provision is not in the charter, then people will think that ASEAN is not pro-human rights, and that is nonsense. We are for human rights. We are for civil liberties, you want to see democracy, you want to see the rule of law, you want to see good governance. ASEAN has to move to the new world. It cannot stay at the old line and keep on putting barriers and obstacles or excuses.
The United States and the European Union express support for ASEAN's efforts and hope that the reforms being contemplated would help improve the group's international standing. Javier Solana, the European Union's Foreign and Security Policy Chief, was among the 27 foreign ministers that attended the ASEAN meetings in Manila.
Of course, we will look into the problems of human rights among the member states of ASEAN. I am pretty sure that it's going to contribute to raise the standards of the human rights among the countries of ASEAN. That is the purpose of putting that into the charter.
Civil society groups are less impressed with ASEAN's progress after 40 years. At a think tank forum being held in Singapore just days after the meetings in Manila closed, delegates are worried that the proposed ASEAN charter has become too watered down and might not help the group face up to the challenges of the future. Debbie Stothart of the Bangkok-based Alternative ASEAN Network on Burma lamented that the proposed charter was becoming a document that does not allow ASEAN to ensure compliance among its members, a problem that has plagued the group over the past 40 years.
We want to see ASEAN as being transformed into a part of the solution for the problems plaguing Southeast Asia. We are concerned that ASEAN itself is setting the bar too low and it's aspiring to the lowest common denominator. We believe that for a region that's strong and vibrant and solutions-oriented, we have to aspire to be much more than the sum of our parts.
While the charter would include provisions for the creation of a human rights body, the draft does not include key proposals to allow ASEAN to impose sanctions on erring members or to make decisions by voting, as opposed to the current consensus-based approach. Stothart said the lack of these provisions were frustrating civil society groups.
Many ASEAN bureaucrats have been continually talking about a step-by-step approach. The reality is that the problems and threats facing ASEAN have not emerged in a step-by-step process. They are outstripping the pace of reform that is in ASEAN, and we need to be very systematic and very effective if we are going to survive and thrive as a region.
Foreign ministers are hoping to be able to present a final draft of the ASEAN Charter for the approval by the leaders in November in Singapore. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurli Linau in Manila.
Indonesia's president signed a comprehensive anti-trafficking bill this year that provides law enforcement authorities the power to investigate all forms of trafficking, setting up aid workers and police in high-risk areas to prevent and investigate trafficking cases. But local officials say they don't have the resources they need, and human trade continues. According to government figures last year, 80% of child sex trafficking cases occurred in the Indramayu area in West Java. Rebecca Henschke tells the story of one 17-year-old survivor, Yulianti.
I have 5 clients a day at the most. I hate it and try to refuse them. Then they would beat me. However, it's better to be hit than to serve them.
Just 3 months ago, she escaped from a brothel in Sarawak, Malaysia, where she had been held since April. The afternoon sun casts shadows over her face as she sits on the porch of her family house in Indramayu. Frogs can be heard in surrounding rice paddies. This peaceful scene is a dramatic contrast to where she's been. She tells me that in January she was sold to a pimp by the name of Roki by another man called Iwan. She met Iwan at a friend's house and he promised her a job as a housemaid in Malaysia. Instead, she was forced into sex work. 7 nights a week she was forced to serve many men. She was paid nothing.
Some nice customers gave me tips. I had to hide the money because they would steal it from me. Because they were scared we would run away. They would search our bodies and our bags for money.
Yulianti tried to run away, but she was caught by the pimp. He threatened to report her to the police as an illegal migrant if she tried to escape again. Bravely, she tried to flee 5 weeks later and succeeded.
I asked one of my neighbors' advice. I said I want to run away tomorrow. They told me to go to the police and also to the Indonesian embassy. So I ran away through the jungle. If I ran through the streets, they would find me. I was scared that they would bring a samurai and use it to harm or even kill me.
The police first took Yulianti to the Indonesian consulate in Sarawak. Yulianti says she left 3 other traffic victims from Indonesia in the brothel. They were too frightened to run away, she says. According to the Indonesian government, 2,600 victims of trafficking returned to Indonesia from Malaysia last year. Yulianti believes she knows where her trafficker Iwan is, but the police have failed to take up her case.
We have to bribe them to get them to do anything. My mother's family has filed 2 reports to the police about my case. They tell me I have to file my case with the police in Central Jakarta because that is where Iwan is. My case has to be approved, the Central Police first, but they have done nothing.
The mayor of Indramayu, Irmanto Suouftin, claims the police don't have the resources to do their job.
We're busy with our daily duties and there is no budget. It's very limited. Yes, it's true we have not done enough, but we will try to do more. Most of the police officers are busy with their own routines, so they don't focus on trafficking.
Indramayu, where Yulianti comes from, is an impoverished rural area. A lack of employment opportunities forces women to work overseas. Ari Numajan is with the local welfare and employment department.
Indramayu is a farming area. So where can young people work? They are not interested in farming anymore because they cannot make enough money. So they are forced to find work overseas. They want money for motorbikes, houses and jewelry.
This makes them vulnerable to human traffickers. Despite the horrific experience her daughter has gone through, Yulianti's mother hopes she can go overseas again to earn money.
My life is like this. My daughter can't go anywhere for anyone, so she can't help her family. Other people's daughters can go overseas and work. I want my daughter to be able to do that.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rebecca Henschke of Radio 68H in Jakarta, Indonesia.
Hundreds of day laborers and their allies converged in Washington, D.C. to participate in the 4th Annual National Day Laborer Organizing Network Convention, which concluded this weekend. The conference, titled Carving the Present, Weaving Our Future, focused on the immigration debate and workers' interests. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Participants kicked off the weekend by going to Capitol Hill and sending a message to Congress. John Arvisa, Development Director for the National Day Laborer Organizing Network.
We did legislative educative visits to talk a little bit about raids and asking for a moratorium on the raids to stop shattering families. And essentially, it's you know, the raids that are happening are really tearing apart families.
Founded in 2001, the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, otherwise known as NDALON, is an alliance of community-based organizations whose focus is to improve the lives of day laborers in the U.S. The goal of this year's conference was to bring these organizations together to look at some of the issues confronting day laborers on a local and national level. Arvisa says in addition to trips to the Capitol, other activities are planned.
There's workshops on ESL and how that's given at day labor centers. There's workshops on media and the different roles that media plays in the movement. There's also a workshop on popular art and how to use art and culture within the movement.
Participants in the conference came from around the country. Carlos Ortiz runs a day laborer worksite in Florida. He says these sites are important to workers.
It offers them a place of security where they can come in, feel safe, and at the same time be able to find a job without having to deal with the uncertainties of what goes on the streets.
According to a recent report from UCLA, on any given day, more than 117,000 workers are either looking for day labor jobs or working as day laborers. Nicholas Mora is a day laborer from Oakland who attended the conference. He says day laborers face many challenges, including not getting paid and trying to stay safe on job sites.
Yes, yes, there are definitely work violations because they don't give us the equipment that we need. For example, gloves, goggles, hard hats, boots. We are missing all kinds of things.
Increasingly, women are a growing part of the day labor market. Maria Refugio, another day laborer, attended the conference from Los Angeles.
In the past, women did not used to go out into the streets, but recently more and more women go out to the corners.
because we can do the same kind of jobs. We can paint, we can cut a lawn, we can do anything. We don't have barriers anymore.
She also says that safety is a serious issue.
En el riesgo de las mujeres. Yo soy voluntaria en un centro de trabajo porque he visto muchas cosas malas en contra de nosotros.
The risks women face. Well, I'm a volunteer in a workers' center because I've seen the bad situation we face as women. We face a lot more danger because sometimes there's the risk of getting raped. Many women have been taken in cars, getting raped in cars or in the workplace. Aside from that, there's sexual attacks from bosses. We have a lot more dangers than men. It's just that sometimes, well, for one reason or another, it's not talked about. But yes, we face a lot more risks as women.
Gustavo Torres is president of the board of directors of Indolan. He says race continues to be a factor in those who want to target day laborers.
It's more than 100,000 Canadians who are undocumented right here in the United States. You never see those people from the Minutemen or those people who are ultra-right accusing the Canadians who are undocumented or accusing Europeans who are undocumented. They don't make any comments about that. They make comments about Latinos and people from the Middle East and, you know, people from Africa. From our viewpoint, it's not only because the people are undocumented, but because the color of skin is a very clear example of discrimination and racism in those ultra-right people, without no question.
Conference organizers say that this year's conference was the biggest ever and that they will continue to push immigration reform as a way to bring citizenship and political equality to day laborers. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Scholar Ward Churchill has just been handed the academic equivalent of a death sentence when the Board of Regents of the University of Colorado voted to remove him from his professorial post there. Churchill has been the target of the rabid right since he published an essay shortly after 9/11, which likened Americans in their attitudes to Nazis. From that point forward, academics at the university began sharpening their pencils to find the way to separate Churchill from his tenured position. Indeed, his works, many of which are anti-imperialist in nature, has also made him an enemy of the right-wing nationalists and fascists in the corporate media. Churchill has written strong, uncompromising books on the Black Freedom Movements and the Native American Independent Rights Movements. His book, A Little Matter of Genocide, is a tour de force of U.S. and British atrocities against Native peoples. It is so searing, so honest, that it is difficult and painful to finish. As for his post-9/11 essay, some people push back on the justice of roosting chickens. Churchill sought to engage the question posed by millions in the aftermath of the burning towers, like, why do they hate us? It may sound rhetorical to compare Americans to little Eichmanns, but before the Second World War, Nazi and fascist support groups were flourishing in America. This may prove unpopular for Americans to hear, but it is the truth. Ward Churchill is precisely the kind of scholar that Americans need to read and hear. He is a brave and brilliant man who has slain his share of sacred cows. As America engages in a global war based on lies, they need him now more than ever. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.